Welcome. You are watching the DTFH, aka the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast. And today we have a returning guest. If you're a fan of the Midnight Gospel, he's Clancy's meditation teacher, David. He also happens to be Duncan's meditation teacher, David Nickturn. And this has got to be my favorite conversation with him ever, as far as the podcast goes. So this was a really, really, really premiere episode, and I thank you for being here to watch it. We're going to talk about Lindsay Clancy, the Hell Realms, and the fundamental goodness that exists within all things. Also, if you're into this episode, you should definitely check out a Dharma Moon live info session, which is coming up just next week. All the links will be down below. It's Tuesday, August 25th. You can actually have a chance to see David talking about Buddhism and mindfulness, and potentially you can interact with some of the Dharma Moon people. All the links you need to find David are down below. And I hope you'll come and see me at the Emerald City Comedy Club in Seattle, September 4th, 5th, and 6th. After that, I'm going to be in Dallas and Fort Worth at Hyenas Comedy Club. And then October 23rd, I'm going to be in Detroit at Mike Drop Comedy. I hope to see you there. God bless you. Hare Krishna. So that's a good start, if you ask me. That's a good start.
Okay.
That's what.
Very good.
That's what the Buddha would have wanted. You know, you don't hear that much, do you? It. You do. It is interesting though. Like, you know, you hear things like WWJD. What would Jesus do? How often do you hear that about what would Buddha do? I guess people just aren't familiar. But don't you ask yourself that sometimes? Like, what would Buddha do in this situation? You know, like when your audio is fucking up on your podcast. You know, it's fun to think the Buddha. What would Siddhartha Gautama, the enlightened being, what would he be like in the modern world with all of the world's difficulties?
You know, you already lost the battle if you're asking that question.
I have lost the battle.
Because what you really want to ask is, what would you do if you had the same level of understanding and realization?
Okay, well, that's a different question. As I was thinking about this conversation with you, I was thinking there was some kind of personality to historic Buddha. There was a personality there, and that personality was mixed in with the awakened mind, but it was still there, right? Like, he wasn't like a abyss, a talking vortex of wisdom. There was a self, a being there. He died of food poisoning. He had food preferences, probably.
Yeah. So in different Buddhist presentations, this is maybe more or less important to assess who was this person, what exactly did they iterate, what's the source for that? Because, you know, for example, they didn't have a written language. So for 200 years after Buddha died, it was purely oral tradition.
Yeah.
And then they had a council and tried to reconstruct what, you know, I visualize some little old Jewish lady in the back of the hall saying, "What did he say?" You know, like for 200 years.
Yeah, right. Like, to put that into perspective, that's us headed back to the 1800s, where there was some kind of brilliant person who never wrote anything down and moved so many people that generations of people kept talking about the things this person was talking about. And then suddenly right now, somebody is like, "Guys, we got to get together and figure out what exactly this guy was talking about." 200 years is a long, long, long time. A lot can get scrambled in that game of telephone.
Which is why a literal rendering, it can only take you so far, but it can take you so far in that at least you have some source code to assess.
Right.
But if you don't do the assessment yourself, and you just have adopted this set of regulations, let's say from somebody who lived a long time ago, to me, that's not really the full Monty right there.
What is the full Monty?
So whatever input you have coming in, you should assess with the same degree of, you know, remember that your Dharma name, Flaming Sword of Prajna.
I do.
Get that flaming sword out and see if it's true, see if it's conditionally true, absolutely true, if it's relevant, if it's expressible in contemporary cultural context, if it's serving the well-being of oneself and others. And otherwise, there's no point in hanging on. Like that guy, Ben Turpin, used to hang on to the clock in the silent movie.
Yeah, right.
You don't want to be that kind of practitioner, you know?
No, but I don't. But let's start at the very top. The term Buddhism. Are there other names for it that are more accurate as to what it is? Is there obviously, or has it always been called Buddhism? What are some different names for Buddhism going back through the centuries?
Well, so even within Buddhism, let's clarify a couple of things that might be, you know, relevant. One is Buddha's not a name. You know, it's not like, oh, there's Fred, Arnold, and Buddha, you know, over there sitting on the bench.
Right.
It is a word that means, roughly speaking, awakened. Awakened to what? You have to, you know, understand that too. And there have been many Buddhas throughout history.
Right.
And if you study, you would say this Buddha was the fourth one in a garland of 1,000 Buddhas. That's one of the things that you would come across. So it's not a name. It is a description
title.
Of a kind of title in a sense, or you know, describing a certain aspect of yourself that is you know, brought to full fruition.
Okay, let's I'm sorry to cut you off. Let's go 50 years after this particular Buddha's death. What were they calling this practice?
It's a great, great question in a way. And like you, I think about this because I was a big fan of Mr. Peabody's Wayback Machine, if you remember that.
Yeah.
Like, I've always wanted to go on Mr. Peabody's Wayback Machine, go back to Jesus, go back to Buddha, and like, and then you'd cut to a picture of me like this because, you know, it didn't map exactly to what you might have hoped for.
Right.
Like, I think, how did people hear the Buddha?
Yeah.
They didn't have microphones. They had big groups of people. And I've heard answers to that, that there were speakers halfway into the audience who would repeat what he said. Right. Who knows?
Who knows?
The point is that the Buddha is a principle. I'm going to go full on with this. It's a principle of a way of being. And if you fully manifest that, you are a Buddha. And I have, in the Vajrayana tradition, there are Buddhas all the time appearing. Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche or somebody like that is considered to be the Buddha in the flesh, not just somebody who carries on, but a source code for the whole thing.
Yeah, well, okay, so yeah, this seems to be one of the mistakes people make when they, you know, most people have just heard about Buddhism. You know, when I was much younger, I thought it was like the fat dude in the Chinese restaurant, the statue of the fat guy, which is, I think, Confucius. Right. I don't even think it's Buddha, but a lot of people are at that level of understanding with it. But they were born into Christian families. And so they conflate the messianic Jesus idea with the Buddha idea. In other words, they think this was a messiah being, like the Son of God level. But what you're saying is not so much. This is actually a phenomena that, if we're going to use the story of Jesus as the Son of God, which I know you're not, Buddhism is generally non-theistic, but that happens once. You get one Jesus. Like there are twice, I guess, when Jesus comes back. But so you get two occurrences of this. Whereas in Buddhism, you get multiple occurrences of this consciousness, this level of this way of seeing the world and of expressing yourself into the world. And that happens more than twice if there's humans about.
Yeah. And starting where you started with, one has one's own personal journey is part of that. So it's, and you know, we've talked about this a bunch of times, of the absolute and relative truth. So, and they're said to be inseparable, which means that even if somebody had this, achieved this kind of wakeful extremely fruitional state, it's still Duncan. It still has four children at home. Yeah. It still has, maybe bills to pay. It still has decisions to make. So how those two ride together, I think, is confusing for most people, even spiritual practitioners, especially spiritual practitioners. How would you integrate that? And how would you not idealize, reify somebody who's achieved that and dehumanize them in doing that?
Dehumanized, yeah, because that is sort of the, I guess, the fantasy would be that there's some kind of spiritual winning the lottery that could happen to a person. And upon that happening, what's commonly called enlightenment, no more mortgage, no more social security number, no more bills, no more kids' tuition fund, no more 401ks, just something you can't understand because it hasn't happened to you, man. But in reality, it's like, no, all of these things.
Yeah.
So one, maybe to answer my own question from the beginning, though it might be missing the mark a little bit, a Buddha in modern times is still going to pay bills, is still going to have to decide how much to tip at a restaurant, is still going to have to know how to call an Uber, get in a taxi, book an air, a flight. Like, meaning that as you're walking through the airport, as you're going down the street, the next time you're at the shopping mall, you easily might pass an enlightened being who's headed to buy cat litter. You know, you that's what you're saying. It could be anywhere.
Well, yes, and what a relief.
What a relief.
And my teachers would say they could do all that stuff better. The clarity would not just only be about the ultimate nature of things, but which cat litter to buy, you know, which app on your phone would tell you which cat litter to buy. It's not, Trungpa Rinpoche used to say that if enlightenment was some kind of like blasting your molecules into hyperspace, we would need an enlightenment ward in the hospital. Because if a Buddha was not functional and couldn't function in relative reality, you'd have to have them in a wheelchair and roll them around.
Somebody help me. I'm getting enlightened. Holy shit. Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, so
that's cool.
And Duncan, you know, this is hero worship. We have it as part of our makeup. It's part of our ability to inspire, aspire. It's okay. But the idea of putting people up on a pedestal at every level, and then, unfortunately, we also have the tendency, once that happens, to want to pull them down.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, that includes religious figures, political figures, and, you know, entertainers. And
I really, I liked the text you sent me, the article where they mentioned you and Trungpa Rinpoche. Could you tell that story? Because it's such a cool story. And it is kind of, it's what's gotten me thinking about all of this. But that story.
You know, friends of mine, and including me, you know, we play with AI, and some of my spiritual friends are playing with it at a level that is kind of a little bit like, okay, you know, let's verify, or let's come down a notch once you, let's not reify AI either, for that matter, even though it's a very, very fast learner.
Yeah.
You know, so she was asking a question about a quote that she remembered being attributed to my teacher. And it got right into, oh, David Nichtern, you know, it was about Trungpa Rinpoche, and then David Nichtern said this about it. And all of a sudden, it kind of knew somehow that she and I knew each other. It seemed to.
Yeah.
And you might be interested in this aspect. And then it was actually me that had asked the question of him, which was, you know, related to our kinds of conversations. Actually, it was quite mirror-like in that way.
Yeah.
I would ask a question like, you know, which the last conversation I ever had with him, Duncan, was he asked me how I was doing. He was already on his way leaving this world, but he asked me how I was doing. I said, well, Mipta, you know, life has had its ups and downs. And he just looked at me kind of somewhat hollowly, you know, and just said, of course, what do you want to hear from a mentor in a case like that? Well, what's been happening? How are you? Tell me about it. He just looked at me and said, which comes first? And as far as I'm concerned, those were his actual last words that we ever spoke.
Yeah. This episode of the DTFH has been brought to you by Blue Chew Gold. And I know you might be thinking, wait, I thought I was listening to a podcast about Buddhism, and here you are talking about boner pills? Yes, your assessment of the situation is correct. We've transitioned from one of the great Buddhist teachers alive today to me telling you that Blue Chew Gold works. And it does. I tried it. I finally got my hands on some of this beautiful Blue Chew Gold, and wow, full Trussell endorsement without getting icky. I think I already got icky, but without getting more icky by going into great detail about the effect that this stuff had on me, I just want to say it gets 6 DTFH golden boners. That's the highest amount you can get. Blue Chew Gold is better sex in a tablet. They combine 4 ingredients into one powerful solution. 2 ingredients get you hard physically, and 2 support arousal and desire in the brain. It works fast. I can attest to that, and it lasts. I can definitely attest to that. Like, into the next day. I mean, it's not like I was like erect for 24 hours, which I think is means you go to the emergency room. I'm not positive about that. You know, in a more civilized society, we would have an actual emergency room. If you had an unwanted boner, you just go there and they heal you. But we're not there yet, guys. We're not there yet, but we will be. There's a reason Blue Chew is the number one brand for better sex. Experience it yourself at BlueChew.com. And we've got a special deal for our listeners. Right now, when you buy 2 months of Blue Chew Gold, you get the third free with promo code Duncan. That's promo code Duncan. You will also receive an additional 10% off plus free overnight shipping on your first order. Visit BlueChew.com for more details and important safety information. And I thank Blue Chew for sponsoring the pod and the bedroom. Which comes first, you know, up or down?
And then the AI gave a little interpretation of it.
Yeah, I like the interpretation. And
it also included the quote about, you know, another time when I was sharing with him that I was having a difficult time, he gave me this pith instruction, which I've given to you and many other people because I consider it a very helpful. He said, don't panic when things are going bad, which I was. I was sort of starting to panic. But then he added to it, don't relax when things are not going well.
Right.
I mean, I'm sorry. Don't relax when things are going well.
Are going well.
And yeah, that is, you know, equanimity there is that you don't bias your experience too strongly towards just, oh, success, you know, and you become a manic depressive practitioner. You know, it's going well. It's not going well. She loves me. She loves me not. She loves me. She loves me not.
Yeah.
So it attributed it to me. Somehow it knew that I was the person who'd ask that question. And then I thought, have I ever written this down? Or is it watching my videos of teaching?
There's no telling. It easily could be. It probably is. She might have mentioned something. Who knows? There's something written. If it's on the written record, the thing probably knows. But, you know, that question, which comes first, or that, you know, pointing out of how you're not getting one without the other, the classic cliche stuff, no mud, no lotus, that anytime you're picking out up versus down or down versus up, are you making a mistake? Would that be considered a distortion in the sense that you have framed out this is down, even though for some people your down is their greatest day on earth, and for some people your up is their worst day alive, meaning that you've sort of picked out one or the other?
Yeah, well, it's really pointing towards the relative relational truth as being one of the two truths. And this is where I think it's easy to get befuddled, because we tend to get very absorbed in relational truth, you know, and track ourselves and kind of make sure it's going the direction we meant it to go. And or we tend to get reify the absolute truth and say, it's all empty. There's nothing happening. You know, it's just a big empty universe and none of this matters. It's a dream, you know. And the truth of the two truths is that the two truths are inseparable from each other.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is like a little bit, you just have to assess how that person operates in the world to know if they have some understanding of the two truths being inseparable.
Right. Yeah. I mean, is that one of those I think most people have some idea of they know that. They understand that at some level these things are connected. But then it's very easy to fuzz that out and get fixated on one or the other. Either you're evading one to get to the other, or you're clinging to one to try to keep from rolling back down the hill. Every once in a while, you might recognize that things are just pretty much the way they've always been, regardless of up or down. It's always, you know, it's this comic. I think I've said this to you before, and I wish I could remember his name, or maybe it's a lot of comics. It's not, I guess, the most brilliant joke on earth, but I was a young comic when I saw him say it. I was like, holy shit, man. What a genius. He goes, you know, Taco Bell, it's just five ingredients, like, you know, it's like put together different quantities. When I say it, I really was mind blown, man. I must have been pretty stoned. It's true, man. He cracked the code at Taco Bell. But when you're sort of like in a high moment and you look at the experience, it's strangely like a low moment. There's, you know what I mean? There's an intensity.
Like a what?
Like a low moment. You know what I mean? In high moments, things are great. Holy shit, I got the email. It's happening. Oh my God, it's in the works. Here we go. There's a kind of joyful frenzy to it or something, you know? Or maybe it's not business related. It's a family peak utopian moment. You're watching your children on the beach. The sun is setting. This is the beach that you played on as a child. And here you are, your mother, you can feel her spirit in the air. And yet in that moment, there's a kind of melancholy or a sort of like a flavor to it that isn't quite all the way sweet. Then in the low moments, you're like, oh, fuck, I'm back here again, man. Oh, there's a sweet familiarity to it. There's a kind of joyfulness to the thing. Even at the worst moment, you're driving to the children's hospital. The baby's been puking. You know what? The wife is upset. But somehow in those moments, there's a kind of sweetness, a kind of joy. There's something real, resonant, scary, terrifying. Dear God, the fragility of life. How quickly can life flee the mortal coil? But mixed into that is all this love and caring. And so, you know, all I'm saying is the ups and the downs, when you start looking at them, it's just different ingredients. It's the same ingredients, just sort of mixed in differently. Does that make sense?
What you just said is worth reiterating. It's not only does it make sense, but it's poignant and true at the same time. So the relative truth, you know, I mean, the way I'd frame it is, what you're really describing is manic depression.
Yeah.
And we all have it.
Yeah.
Because we chase the highs and try to avoid the lows is the only reason it becomes problematic. So what the meditation practice is inviting is to say, don't chase the highs and don't avoid the lows. That's what Trungpa Rinpoche's comments meant to me. Don't chase the highs and don't avoid the lows. And it doesn't it does away with ignorance and attachment in one swoop there.
Yeah.
You're cutting through ignorance and you're not ignoring anything, and you're not attaching to anything as having sort of hyper meaning.
Yeah.
But you're staying awake. You're staying Buddha.
Right.
And, you know, and this is only conversation I'm having these days, actually, Duncan, with everybody.
Really?
Yeah. In a way, in the spiritual community, you could think of it as a left-right spectrum of, like, highly relational stuff. And also people who are, like, really trying to elevate the situation and see it as kind of pristine and clear and unobstructed. It just is what it is.
Yeah. Right.
And so they use words like dharmata, suchness, but nobody believes it. So you got to keep, like, it's like being a herder. You keep moving the sheep towards that. What it is not only good, but it's also unavoidable.
Right. Right. I mean, it is what's happening.
Yeah, you either can try to pump it up or try to cut it off, or all the moves that we make that are habits. So I think in Buddhism, a very important, as it's evolved as a practice, as a way of looking at things, is to pay careful attention to the habitual patterns of one's own life and mental continuum. Right. Really pay attention to that, notice it, and then to some extent dismantle some of the attachment and ignorance that's perpetuating those habits.
Right. Like, what would be a very simple example of that kind of dismantling?
Road rage.
Okay. Yeah.
Somebody cuts you off and you go, you do the, I'm from New York. I know how to do the whole bit. You know, you're cutting me off, you know, it's like, and as a practitioner, that's going to happen to you. Somebody else is, you were driving well and safely, but they are, you know, on the LIE here and they're cutting you off. And you watch, you notice your own reaction to that.
Yeah.
And how it grips you. It's called Shenpa. You know, it's kind of like this Shenpa. Tendency for your emotional. Yeah, Shenpa.
Scary.
Your emotional reactivity takes over.
Scary. Right?
And now you're like, and then it as we've discussed before, it captivates your intelligence.
Yeah.
You start making logical summaries of what should happen, what shouldn't happen, why this should be this way or that way. So if you can just see that, which is what meditation practice should be about or can be about, is just observing, seeing it clearly, you don't have to be gripped by it in exactly the same way going forward.
How do you get to the road?
I think that's the best one.
Sorry to misinterpret what you're saying. I'm thinking of that should be the name of my podcast. When you meditate, when you're sitting, you're watching your mind, your thoughts, all of the various forms of it that you've taught me. If I meditated more, this would happen. I don't think that I've ever found myself in a state of profound road rage while meditating. That I maybe different levels of it, maybe a kind of anxiety, paranoia, panic, nervousness, but like that particular form of shimpa, that the murderous rage that can burst into your heart from one trigger, this form of it is causing so much suffering around the planet at any given moment. People are strangling, punch, and they weren't bad, but they were relatively calm. That's the scary part. They were relatively calm before they got it snapped on them. Oh my God, it's so terrifying. And when it happens to you profoundly, like when you really are gone, you only know it's happening when you're realizing, like, why am I holding a croquet mallet right now? I don't need to be brandishing a croquet mallet at somebody. I'll tell you the story off the podcast. But you know what I mean? That's scary. That shimpa that you're talking about. How would you dismantle that through a sitting practice or through a meditation practice or through some form of Buddhism?
So usually it's probably a two-step process. Awareness, bring more awareness. Hmm. Present awareness sees these kind of arising with clarity. Awareness is naturally clear in its own way. It's just seeing it. It's not investing in it. You're not assessing, you know, whether to do this or do that. You're just seeing it without judging it and without manipulating it. That's really a hard thing to learn. That's a really good thing to learn. Not by avoiding it, not by negating it, not by boycotting it, not by bypassing it, just seeing it arise. Yeah. And then the second step would have to be in a really good progression would be shifting.
Yeah.
And that would be, you know, that you're actually now making your next move in a chess game. Right. You see the lay of the land on the chessboard. I got here. I'm trapped between this guy's rook and this guy's queen.
Yeah.
You assess the situation and now you have to make your next move. What's it going to be? Are you going to knock the pieces off the board? Or are you going to like tip your king over and say, well, let's play another game, you know?
Right. Yeah. I mean, when you describe it like that, it sounds very heady. It sounds very it's strategic in a way that maybe I don't think most people think of a spiritual practice as some form of chess.
Well, the tricky aspect of it is you look across at your opponent and their face morphs into your face. You realize you're playing yourself in a game of chess. That's what life, in a sense, is.
Boring. That's what prisoners do, right? That's like, isn't that the classic prisoner game? In movies, it's a trope. The dude in a cell with a chessboard is playing himself.
It's called retreat practice.
right.
You go into a place and there's nobody else there, and then, you know, what unfolds in your mind is clarified to be unmistakably of your generation. You know, you generated it. So therefore, you either are going to like thrash around with not being comfortable with your own self and your own mind, or you're going to start to work with it with gentleness, all the things we talk about, clarity, precision. Yeah. But I think, you know, I'm going back, Duncan, to what you said, because I'm super concerned about this. And when you said it, it just resonated. There's too much aggression in the world right now.
Yeah.
Not healthy.
Yeah.
And that sounds like a dumb thing to say, maybe in a way, kumbaya, whatever. Say whatever you want about it. But people are reactive and going into reactive states. And a lot of equipment is set up to support that that style of existence to get you triggered. You know, and then manipulate you for whatever purposes that they might have. So anything that dials that automatic aggression down is good, even if it's just taking a walk or listening to music or having a nice meal or meditating, God forbid.
God forbid. He does forbid it. God forbids meditation. He does. Wouldn't that be wild if they made meditation illegal? But this thing that you're talking about, I like one angle that I really like is the recognition that when a person has upset you, they are controlling you to some degree. It might not be a sophisticated kind of control. At some levels, it is. But if I can get you freaking out, I've already controlled you. It's like I found a trigger in you that I could switch and make you have a kind of transient seizure. And that's a lot of power that you could have over somebody. And so I agree with you that there seems to be an intentional, almost pulsed out attempt to trigger people into varying states of aggression that is coming from a bunch of different sources, but strangely, it all feels like the same plan or something. It's this, maybe it's the 24-hour news cycle. Maybe it's politics. Maybe it's some, you know, psyop from another country, or maybe it's who you could come up with, whatever. It's the fucking sun. It's solar flares, man. It's aluminum in the air. I don't know. But it is for sure a quality of the present day that doesn't remind me of the 90s. It doesn't remind me of the, it seems like a hyper aggressive time for sure.
Yeah. And, you know, whatever insight can be brought to that, because it's a runaway train at the moment with a lot of momentum towards exactly doing, you know, exactly triggering people in a manipulative way. And, you know, not many people are just, you know, speaking from their heart, speaking the truth. It almost looks like unbelievable if somebody does that. Like, yeah, you're a fool, right. You're naive, you know.
Right, right.
You just don't get the game, you know. You're not in the game.
That's right. Yeah. What are you doing? Like, do you understand the danger you're putting yourself in by expressing exactly who you are in the present moment? Like, this is not the time for that. This is not the time to be fully yourself. It's going to get you arrested or outcast or.
Well, and that is that that, you know, as a group, that moves us towards autocratic forms of of connecting with people. Because if people get it, it's the jealous God realm. And, you know, when we talk about the six realms,
yeah,
it's that idea of power being a currency that is nutritious in some sense. People are looking for nutrition, Duncan. That's the way I look at it. Feeding a hungry person is the whole situation. And depending on the way the mind is shaped and set, power can look like food.
Right.
It doesn't really fulfill your appetite. You're still hungry.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's that, you know, that Chinese German restaurant. You know that one?
What? Chinese German?
This is horrible. I'll probably get
it. We can cut it out. We can cut it out if you regret it. Let's hear this joke. It's a joke, people. Go ahead.
A half hour after you eat there, you're hungry for power again.
That's hilarious.
It's very vintage, very old, and it's before all this, you know, stuff. But anyhow, that's what I grew up with. Coming back to just seriously, power in the jealous God realm, power, it becomes the attempt at nutrition. In the God realm, it's bliss or happiness and ease become the nutrition. In the animal realm, it's just getting your next meal, becomes it. In the hungry ghost realm, it becomes something that continues to recede from you. You can't quite get at the nutrition. And then in the hell realm, it's you're at a horn and hard arts and everything's locked. You know, you can't get at the food.
Yeah.
You can't do anything to get out of your own state of mind and get out of your own way, even for a second. And that's us. All six of those is us. And all six of those is Buddha. At the same time.
Right. Well, explain to me how, let's take a trip down to the hell realms. You're in the place where the pantries are locked. All the stores are closed. The lights are turned off. You're not getting anything, friend. Now, how is that?
And you hate yourself.
And you hate yourself.
You hate yourself for having gotten into such a mess too.
Yeah. So I have a perfect example of that. I don't know if you've been following this trial. Have you been following this trial of what's her name? Lindsay Clancy. What's her name? Josh Lindsay Clancy. Yeah. You know about this, David?
Only a little bit, but
without just vomiting the darkest thing you've ever heard on earth. The details, the essence of the thing is you have this woman on trial who murdered her children. And she had severe postpartum depression, probably postpartum psychosis, desperately tried to get help. No one could identify like how bad it was. And then she ends up doing just the most unimaginable thing possible that you could do, is kill your children. And now you see her on trial. She, of course, breaks down throughout the, she's sobbing, but you look at that, that's the hell realm. There, I can't think of a more hopeless situation. Let's say it's a hung jury. You get to walk. Or let's say that you get a reduced sentence. Or let's say that you sue the psychiatrist who over-medicated you or didn't identify what was happening with you, and you make millions of dollars. You're still a mother who murdered her children. And there's no out. There's no way out from that. You can't fix it. It's hell realm, right? That's hell realm. So where's the Buddha in that? Where's Buddha? Where's the awakened part of that?
The awakened part of that experience would have to center around forgiveness. Mm. Somehow, and this is what some religious traditions are very good at, in my opinion. Mm. Like, I think the Christian tradition has a very beautiful sense of forgiveness.
But you're saying she has to forgive herself?
Well, but if you can't do that, you use an intermediary, you know, a priest,
right?
A great being of some kind. They lean in and they help show you how to do that. And you attribute it to their power, not to your own, as an intermediate step. So I think in the hell realm, we practice metta, loving kindness. You have to forgive yourself. You have to forgive other people. And that is so powerful. Most of us don't know how to do that at all, even without the hell realm. Don't you think it's hard to forgive yourself, even for just like saying the wrong stupid thing sometime?
Sure.
To your wife. You can't even forgive yourself. It's going to resonate in your mind for like a month.
Right. Yeah,
so
sure.
I think there's something powerful in that. And then, in each of the realms, Duncan, there's a Buddha type of being communicating with those beings according to their obsession.
I'm going to pause you there for 1 second. I need to plug my computer in. But can you hold that thought? Because I want to continue right from this spot.
Sure.
I'm so sorry. This episode of the DTFH has been brought to you by Quince. I had it the other day. The first, that feeling you get towards the end of summer? Just for a second, you feel like fall coming. And you think, is this just my own imagination? I'm in Texas. I just saw a bird catch on fire while it was flying. But I don't think it is. I just think we just feel the approach of fall. And all this is a poetic way to say you got to start buying fall clothes now. It's time. And Quince is the answer to your fall clothes quest. If you're like me, you don't like going shopping in physical stores for stuff. It's annoying. They talk to you. You feel awkward. You want to express to them that no matter what you do, no matter how many spiritual practices you engage in or how many psychedelics you've taken, you still aren't happy with those asymmetrical love handles and weird feet. And so it's already weird that you've got to sort of pick some kind of cloth to drape over this strange, malformed, hairy thing that carries around your soul. So you get weird, and then you leave without buying clothes. This is why Quince is the best. There's a pair of sweatpants I ordered from Quince that is now my go-to sweatpants. I take them on the road with me. And Yeah, they're gross. Not in the sense that they look bad, but in the sense that maybe I could wash them a little bit more than I do. That's how much I love them. Don't want to be apart from them. And I got them from Quince. And what's great about Quince is everything at Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They work directly with ethical factories and cut out the middlemen. So you're paying for high quality, not brand markup. They've got premium denim tailored chinos from just $60. It's nothing these days, especially. It's got a perfect fit, structure, and high quality fabrics you'd expect from a luxury designer brand. Upgrade your everyday. Download the Quince app for app exclusive offers or go to quince.com/Duncan. Get free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada and the UK too. That's quince.com/Duncan. Thank you, Quince, for saving all of us from the horrors of going out into public to buy clothes. In this, to continue, pick up, sorry about that. So in this, using the trial as an example, obviously, even though, you know, some percentage of the population is just like, hang the witch, burn her in a boiling pot. There's obviously people watching this with compassion. In fact, what I'm seeing out there is way more compassion than one might expect. Like after watching this and seeing what she went through and her legitimate, desperate attempts to get help. So she might not be aware of this. I doubt they're letting her online. But maybe she gets letters, but even in that state, she probably is getting messages or contacts from people she's never met who are praying for her, like, legitimately wanting to help, like, a person who's done, I mean, as a parent, you know, that's pretty much it. Like, that's like the worst thing that you could do as a human being on this planet.
Yeah.
I mean, all up there, there's a few others, obviously. You know, you could leave you for, you could not wear headphones in a cafe and watch sports. That's also one of the worst things you can do on the planet. But regardless,
but sometimes, Duncan, if somebody's in a hell realm, they need help. There's often the situation is like, for example, in the 12-step world, you hit that bottom and you go, I can't make it.
Yeah.
I have to admit that I'm not getting where I need to get by myself. Yeah. So I need to ask for help.
Yeah.
And that's a beautiful thing for a human being to ask for help. And some people that's hard for and some people who need that. But I remember hearing that song, Jesus Take the Wheel.
Yeah.
You know that country song?
Sure.
Sobbing like a baby when I heard it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's such a beautiful, like, I can't make it on my own. And in Dharma world, you could invoke a teacher or a guru to say, please help me. Yeah. You supplicate.
Right.
You know, but you're not saying you have it and I don't. That's the difference. That's where it becomes theistic.
Right. Yeah.
You have it and I've forgotten about it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's really cool. So yeah, I guess I misunderstood what you were saying initially, but in all of these, whether they're metaphor, whether it's, you'd want to take it literally, in all of these states of consciousness or maybe states of the universe, there's this omnipresent awakened mind situation that you can access and that can what? I mean, I know.
And it's got, awake is the word for the kind of present and awareness dimension of it, but it's also said to have a warm quality to it,
right,
a compassionate essence. And this is the same essence as every being has, in essence. But as we move through those, you know, realms of of being and karmas and that we generate, we need to be reminded of that possibility, and then sometimes coached a little bit to help reinvigorate our connection with it.
Tell
that's
me about
Buddhism.
That
you asked what Buddhism.
Yes, the coach.
That's Buddhism.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Yeah. That's cool. That is really cool, that warmth part. You know, it brought to mind, right after, God, when was this, man? I'm trying to think if this was after my, I think this might have been after my mom passed away. But I don't remember. I had to go get like a big test to, when you have cancer, you have to keep going back, make sure it hasn't spread. And in the first few years post-cancer, it's a lot. Like, you have to get like checked up fairly regularly, you know, and then the checkups diminish depending on the cancer, but too much information there. But I can remember being really freaked out because I was getting the big old MRI scan. This is the like serious shit, man. They give you the, I can't remember what it's called. They inject you with this stuff. You feel it rush through your body. It's what MRI machine uses to see you. I just freaking out. I remember drinking something you have to drink before. I don't remember the details. But this nurse, and I don't think I was, I probably looked freaked out. I don't know. I was trying to keep it together, but this nurse just walks up to me, like takes my arm, and she goes, "It's okay." Yeah. She goes, "I'm your mom. It's going to be fine. Your mom's here." Just walks off. But it was real. It wasn't woo-woo. It wasn't kumbaya. It was, that warmth was just pouring out of her. And I'll never forget that. It was so quick, but after that, I was less freaked out. Like, it really, whoever that person was or whatever that was, that warmth, that was the fundamental quality of that moment, was this warmth within a fairly alien, fucked up mind space and external space. And this is what we're cultivating in Buddhism, is manifesting that warmth, finding that warmth.
That to be inherent. Mm-hmm. So when you talk about Buddha, it's an unconditional, inherent situation, primordial, without beginning, without end. It just is that way. And it's hard to say, well, is that what human beings are? That's the source code? You could make a lot of arguments against it.
Sure.
But what the Buddha argument is, that is the most indestructible part of a being.
That's bedrock.
We're not operating that level a lot of times because of the habits, the formations, and the kind of obscurations and the obstacles that we face. But she reminded you of your, and if it's not that warmth, it's not Buddha. you don't have a Buddha who's just brilliant and clarifying and penetrating and awake and so smart and so insightful. Without that warmth, it's also not Buddha. So it has those two elements, which are considered some kind of basic nature, you know, and that's why at the more advanced levels of teaching, sometimes the teacher just points to that. It's called pointing out. They just point to that by how they're occupying the space with you. And it has to have this sort of clarity of kind of unobstructed present awareness, and also this warmth of the kind of compassion. That's it. That's and you have to, you're not supposed to just say, oh, well, so-and-so said that. If you don't feel it, then it's not, it doesn't work.
Don't waste your, what are you doing? Like, why are you even wasting your time? Like, it sounds wonderful. Like, of course you would want to feel that. It sounds maybe for some people a little different from what they might have envisioned as an awakened state. You know, I think for some people, it's a very heady state. It's an astral projection kind of state, or a Doctor Strange kind of state. It's not like it's not like drinking
Strange
tea.
Buddha.
It's not like having tea with your kids or something, or like, you know, making your kids pancakes. Like, that's not it.
Yeah.
But it seems more like that than anything else. Just that and to
so
hear
then,
that's the fundamental sort of ground floor.
Basic goodness. It's described different ways. But then you have to really test that out, because if it's not true, you have to say what is true. And then you might get to something like basic badness, you know, which is or original sin or something like that. You fucked up so long ago you can't even remember it. And now we're going to make you pay unless you do X, Y, and Z.
Right.
So I don't know. For me personally, it just has to be gentler and, you know, more heartful than that kind of way of punishing ourselves and punishing others. If Buddhism just becomes a way of punishing yourself and punishing others, it just goes into the basket with the rest of whatever.
Yeah. It's not special at all from that perspective, if that's what it was.
Well, you could use the data points in it to manipulate a conversation towards being a smart person and being perceived as such.
You mean, like my new favorite word, excoriate?
Now, are you saying excoriate?
I said it wrong. I've been saying it for about a month now as an example of saying shit to seem smart when you're an idiot. I think I even told my kids, guys, just say excoriate. People think you're smart. I've been saying it wrong.
I don't think that's the right word, but I could be wrong. I'm not sure.
I give up. Oh, shit. Well, yeah. And
hey, Duncan, I want to ask you a question. How's the comedy world lately? You're still traveling and
oh, that, yeah, gigs? It's interesting. It's like it's somehow become a sort of like vacation situation, which it used to be feel like work. And now, because I've got all these kids, I'm, you know, getting these like days of just, you know, silence. But then mixed in with it is I just miss my kids so much. And so it's got a kind of like somewhat of a bittersweet feeling to it. You just want to get back to your kids, which is, by the way, it's so simultaneously wonderful and challenging. And I mean that. I'm not trying to be a fence rider here. To come home to these beautiful, like, sweethearts just hugging you and, like, you know, asking you crazy. It's the best thing to, like, come home to. But you also have to sort of, like, very quickly shift vibes to sync up, you know, with the family. And that maybe to get back to what we were talking about earlier, maybe there could be some way that experience of coming home is what you're experiencing all the time. If what we're saying is this fundamental goodness is the bedrock, then theoretically that experience is going to happen anywhere. It's everywhere that you, and it, if maybe this is like ripping off Ram Dass a little bit, but by saying, oh, my children, my home, my family, this is what that experience comes from, then you're really saddling your family with like a pretty heavy weight, which is like, you guys have to be the bedrock of fundamental goodness in my life, or whatever the thing is that you think is the caldera of your own fundamental goodness, right? That's limiting. That's a limiting or a lack of remembering.
Unless you, as you just said, can extract the maple syrup from the maple tree and recognize that feeling can be something that can be cultivated, encouraged in relation to other situations. And then you're on the bodhisattva journey. Wow, you're on your way to Buddhahood, but you're stopping along the bodhisattva path of saying, I can distill this experience of a, you know, kind of something that I associate with the best qualities, and I can nurture it and cultivate it and use access it even in situations which make my habits flare up.
You know, you're right.
That is bodhisattva path. That's a great path. I don't think there's enough energy and attention. I think in the West, people want to skip, you know, all the preliminaries and all the middle steps and just have some kind of, you know, sharp, shortcutted, wakeful thing. But to become a compassionate person in situations in which it's challenging is a pretty good accomplishment in this life.
Oh, yeah. Give me a break.
And we appreciate those people. They're not bullshit and they're not faking it. They just are really trying to become more open-hearted, compassionate, sympathetic.
Yeah.
You know, in a way, that should be the universal currency for all of the traditions to come together in that.
You know, I used to go to these, retreats, and inevitably they start talking about the meta practice, bodhisattva stuff. And I would just be like, it was bullshit. Extreme bullshit. The reason I would say that, it was FOMO. I would think it was, or it's a, maybe that's the wrong acronym, but they would usually start you off with like, think of your kid.
Four kids coming home just like you just did.
That. I didn't have that. So they'd be like, think of this or that. And I would try to think, some sentimental thought about, my mom or my family or my grandmother. I might get a little sort of twinge of what I think they were pointing towards. But yeah, now, like you're saying, extract the maple syrup from the, I get it. Oh, I get what you're saying. It's like, now I have a full experience of that, and definitely longing to be back with them is the same thing, right? Like, you could always access that if you could just find it.
Yeah,
a little drop of it is enough, and that's in everybody, but just a little sample. You just need to tune into that experience. This episode of the DTFH is brought to you by BetterHelp. Look, I have done BetterHelp commercials for a long time. I love them. They're a great service, and inevitably I'm talking about the benefits of therapy, but they want me to focus on something that I think really speaks volumes for how great they are, which is how much people love them. You can check it out yourself at betterhelp.com/reviews to see amazing customer reviews in real time. The reviews are updated every day with hundreds of people saying how much they love BetterHelp and how helpful it's been to them. Just visit betterhelp.com/reviews to see for yourself. BetterHelp has an average live therapy session rating of 4.9 out of 5 based on over 1.7 million client session reviews. The feedback from people who have actually used the service speaks for itself. And, let's face it, sometimes one of the things that you will use to not get therapy is that you don't want to go looking for a therapist. You don't want to drive to a therapist's office. You just feel weird about the whole situation. BetterHelp fixed all of that. They will have you fill out a questionnaire. They'll connect you with a therapist that they think is right for you. You can switch at any time if you want to. And that means that you don't have to actually like drive around town to meet therapists. And it gives you a lot more freedom, and it disinhibits you if you are someone who feels a little nervous about starting therapy. See the reviews, see what stands out, and see if BetterHelp is right for you. Visit betterhelp.com/Duncan. That's better, HELP.com/Duncan.
And that coupled with patience and also stability, like the mindfulness practice gives you stability so that your attention doesn't just fluctuate all over the place. The quality of your attention is all over the map. That and patience, now you have the kind of foundation that you need to begin to look at the interpersonal domain.
Right.
But without that intrapersonal cultivation, it's very hard. Yeah. Develop the interpersonal.
Oh, wow. That is cool. Wow, David. I know you're a musician, but have you ever thought about teaching Buddhism?
Well, and here's what's funny about that. I'm trying to bring those things together in new ways. You know that. I'm writing an animated bluegrass Buddhist musical. And I throw that challenge out to anybody who's listening. Do you think you could write one? I want to see it. But you know, the idea of bringing your creative sourcing together,
yeah,
with how you express yourself in life, with your family, with your sense of operating in reality, with your idealized version of how things could be if they were good, and leaving that on the field.
Yeah.
I think that's my jam at this moment.
Yeah.
So I'm telling people, don't quit your night job. You know, be a comedian, be a bass player, for God's sake.
Yeah.
Know?
Right. But
do some practice. This practice is universal enough that I think everybody could get a piece of it without hurting themselves, you know?
I mean, I think anybody who was like, who listened, just experienced what you're talking about. I mean, you're so good at invoking or pointing out that place. You're so good at it. It's in the way that you get there is always, at least in our conversations, it's always different. You know, you're just quite talented at that. It's really cool.
Well, it's like music. We use that, you know, Dharma Moon, we use that metaphor a lot. Learn the music first, and then you become a good improviser.
Right.
If you're improvising because you don't know the music,
right,
you know, you never learned fundamentals or you never learned the song.
Right.
And that was like the great lesson of our, you know, jazz is really and bluegrass has become like jazz in the younger iterations of
right.
it. Great improvising. But
right.
people learn the tune. And then where they go with it becomes extremely kind of fun and
right.
interesting.
That's cool.
You know,
right.
But learn the music, which means learn that in terms of meditation, it means learn the sequence, learn the methods that people have applied, learn the principles, but don't get stuck there. You know, don't get stuck just being, you know, automatic pilot with that.
Right. Yeah. It would be easy. I could see how you would get stuck. Not a terrible place to be stuck. You know, stuck in some strict, by-the-books practice. I mean, better than being stuck watching YouTube videos of people getting arrested.
It depends.
Well, yeah, there's some good videos out there.
That's what's so great. There's another part of the Buddhist tradition people are not as aware of. It became doctrinal, it became monastic at a certain point, but the earliest adopters of the tantric Buddhist tradition were all worldly people.
Yeah.
And you could say eccentric worldly people.
Absolutely.
You could say comedians and bass players
if you
wanted to get really crazy with it. So the idea of the source code for a lot of this is not so much zooming in on the doctrinal right away, but feeling your way into the experience of it. But I think we have such a great variety, and I encourage people as I talk to them, well, what floats your, how do you access information? How do you develop yourself? What's comfortable for you? What's familiar to you? And to me, a good teacher should be speaking the other person's language more than their own.
Huh. Yeah, right. Right. I agree. Yeah. David, thank you so much for hanging out with me again. Yeah, I love it when you do that. It's really cool. So why would it be so, I'm sorry to keep you on the line here, but why would it be so easy to forget such a sweet thing? You know, it's interesting that this thing that, it's like something you texted me before, you know, it's like so simple, you know, it's so wonderful. You don't want to believe it could happen to you. It's so simple though. You know, it's so easy, this thing that we're talking about, you know what I mean? It's so simple, so familiar,
right.
So,
yeah,
you know, what you were born into that mm-hmm. it's so easy to forget. This thing
yeah.
that this is a this sort of connection through the heart, compassion, love. almost anything you do from that place, in that place, is going to be amazing. Whatever it is, it's right. It's like,
well, there also has to be, there has to be skill, there has to be skillfulness too.
I was about to say that. You know, I mean, as a sort of like, okay, I guess a better way to put it is like, you know, when you're a comedian, you write jokes. Sometimes, God help you, sit down to write jokes. And if my mood is like angry, every attempt at writing a joke sucks. It's too edgy. It's jagged. It's just not funny. There's not much there. But you know, in states of like love or where I'm feeling like not some kind of stoned out bliss state, but like in moments where I'm really tuned in with my own life, that is where my creativity like thaws out, you know. Obviously,
have you or anybody else ever written a funny thing happened to me on my way to the gig at the Comedy Store?
No.
Like just something happened that was funny.
That's so right. That's funny. That's cool.
You try to capture those things. Like, right? Do you write them down, or how do you remember when something funny happened and you want to, you know, repeat it?
You take notes in your phone. That's what I do. I mean,
you do.
It used to
okay,
be
so the same. You're the same as a songwriter. It's the same as a songwriter.
Yeah, it used to be people had notebooks. There are still people who like are superstitious. They write their jokes down. They have little notebooks they carry around with them everywhere.
Wow.
But it's, I feel like it's probably mostly moved to your phone, because you'd always lose your notebook, which is mortifying.
Right.
Because inevitably someone's going to pick up your notebook and read it and be like, this is the most brilliant writing I've ever seen in my life. Right, Josh? That's the problem. That's the problem us comedians have, is like, once people see what we write in our notebooks, they want to worship us. They want to bring us, you know, gifts. And it sounds great until your home is surrounded by hundreds of people desperately wanting just to touch your hair because of your comedy joke notebook. Right, Josh? You've had that happen to you.
Several times.
But the point I'm getting at is something funny, or something funny already happened.
Oh, yeah.
And you were like tuned in and you noticed it and captured it.
Yeah, you're talking about just, I know, yeah. We write down everything that we think is funny, and most of the time it's not funny. You just thought it was funny, and then you go back and look at it, and you're like, what the fuck did I even write here?
No, my point is that you didn't create it. Something funny happened.
Oh, I see.
And you noticed it.
Okay, yeah.
So,
right.
I was with my granddaughter, Izzy, who's really funny, Duncan. She's really got sauce. And we're walking through the park at twilight. And this is this blissful, natural. And she starts running around trying to capture something, like a bug or something like that.
Yeah.
Like a 9-year-old would do. And I looked around. There were fire. It was starting to be dusk, and there were fireflies all through the park. And she had one in her hand, and she wanted to take it home, put it in a jar so she could have a little lamp to read from.
That's cool.
The point is the fireflies are there.
Right.
And we're capturing them, but we don't have to invent them. I guess that's what I'm trying to say.
Well said. And thank you. And shouldn't we plug what's coming up? You have another Dharma Moon. This is what's it called? Teacher training program.
Yeah, the 100-hour mindfulness meditation teacher training program. And we have a free info session for that on August 25th. So you can just come and check it out if you want, or you can look it up on the website. I could, if we could put some links into the show notes, I'll send it. But shorthand, go to dharmamoon.com, dharmamoon.com. And think about joining us. You know, quite a few folks have continued to study these things we talk about quite a bit, and it's because of you, Duncan.
No, it's because of you.
You're like a, you're, what do you call it, a channel? You know, you're, And it's been good. So we say this every time, but thank you for supporting that. And we have quite a creative group of people. A lot of them are talented creatives, and we're not asking them to shave their head and drop out and join the monastery. We're saying, keep doing what you're doing. That's what Trungpa Rinpoche said. If you ruled the world, what would be the first edict you would issue? And he said, tell everybody, keep doing what you're doing.
That's amazing. Wow. Cool. Okay. What's the date again, David? When is this? This is next week.
So the free info session is August 25th. And this hopefully will be in the show notes, or go to dharmamoon.com. And then the 100-hour course starts on October 9th. So, you know, there's all kinds of ways to get into it. And we have we've extended the program. There's an advanced teacher training program. So, you know, if anybody's interested, just go to the website and sign up for that info session, or just come join us for the courses that are indicated there. And, you know, all we're trying to do, Duncan, just to be really clear about it, we're not promoting something. We're inviting. And we're trying to make available a process that maybe we felt was helpful to us and pass it through to other people. That's the whole trip there. So it's kind of like I call it the bucket brigade.
I love it. The retreat that we did was amazing. And yeah, folks, this is, I don't know why I feel the need to say this, but I just like connecting you to David. As you can tell from this conversation, he's a great teacher. You will benefit. The retreat we did was just amazing. I think about it all the time, man. That was so great and so well conducted and just perfectly balanced. It really was great. But anyway, look, I got to tell you about this croquet mallet event that happened. But I don't want to do it on the podcast. David, thank you so much for coming on the show. Down below, you'll find the links to connect to David. Definitely check out the info session. Thank you so much, David.
Thank you, and hello to all the Dunkites out there from the Dunk Camp. That's what I came up with today.
Goodbye, Dunkites.
Bye, everybody.
That was David Nickturn, everybody. All the links you need to connect with the info session next week at Dharma Moon will be down below. And come see me at the Emerald City Comedy Club in Seattle. That's September 4th, 5th, and 6th. Until next time. Hare Krishna.